Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and you get to join The Takeaway Club today. We're going to introduce you to our next book club in The Takeaway Book Club series. We'll meet the, I'm not lying here, the He-Men of Minneapolis and find out what novel they have tackled for us later this hour. But first, to the power struggle in Iraq, in Baghdad, between Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the new nominated and U.S.-supported candidate to lead the country, Haider al-Abadi, currently the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, as the country's next prime minister. At the same time, it's war and fighting near the Kurdish city of Erbil. The trapped Yazidis appear to be the target of ethnic cleansing as the days go by the forces of ISIS, a frightening roundup that a good friend of our next guest barely escaped. The Current New Yorker online, George Packer, tells the story of his Yazidi friend and his narrow escape from the clutches of ISIS. Other Yazidis are not so lucky, stranded on Mount Sinjar. Yesterday, the Department of Defense announced that it has sent 130 military advisors to Iraq to plan for the evacuation of the Yazidi refugees, an operation that our partner, the New York Times, says may grow in the coming days. Writer George Packer works for The New Yorker and sat down with me to discuss his assessment of the turmoil in the region. He's the author of The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, and the great book, The Unwinding, for which he won the National Book Award. George Packer says the Iraq as we know it may soon be a thing of the past.
What we're seeing, and I'm certainly not the first to point it out, is a kind of de facto breaking up of the country in the big sectarian and ethnic regions that it has always been divided into, at least since World War I. And Baghdad seems like a place that sucks up all the oil revenues, distributes it through corruption and patronage, does nothing to protect people, you know, in the far-flung provinces, and is becoming more and more just the green zone. And in a way, that's a little bit like more like Afghanistan. Iraq used to have more of a centralized state authority. In fact, it had one of the most centralized regimes on earth under Saddam Hussein. And now it seems as if Baghdad can't control anything beyond Baghdad, and really not even Baghdad itself. The city is now surrounded by ISIS. They've positioned themselves to the west, to the south, to the north, and in some of the Sunni neighborhoods in western Baghdad. Meanwhile, the Americans are back in the game after really trying to stay out for a few years. And it seems as if our officials in Baghdad and in Washington and on Martha's Vineyard, where the president is, have been sending really strong signals that Maliki has to leave and that Haider al-Abadi is acceptable to us as a new prime minister. And he has 30 days to form a government.
What do you make of him? What's his reputation?
I mean, I don't know much about him. He seems like another colorless Dawa Party figure. There's been a long string of them. They've been running the country since 2006 rather badly. First, there was Ibrahim Jaafari, who was too indecisive. And so the Bush administration, Zalmay Khalilzad, our ambassador at the time, pushed hard to get in someone who could be a tougher leader. They thought that that would be Maliki. Turned out he was erratic and had dictatorial impulses and quite sectarian. But what do you expect from these figures out of the Dawa Party, which was in exile all those years and had no democratic background at all and was essentially a revolutionary party against the Saddam Hussein regime? So Abadi comes out of the exact same background. He lived in London for years, which might be a slightly, more opening experience than to live in Syria or Iran as Maliki did. But we don't know. And I think we didn't know about Maliki. This is just hoping that the next guy is better than the last guy. And we've been there before. So I don't think there's any guarantee that Abadi is going to be able to pull together some kind of national unity government.
Meanwhile, the administration points to Kurdistan and Erbil as some sort of model of tolerance and democracy, such as it is in northern Iraq. Can the administration protect Erbil in its policy in northern Iraq and trying to deal with the Yazidis and also advocate for keeping the country together? Kurdistan looks more and more like a de facto oil state.
Yeah. And as one Kurdish leader said, the question is whether we'll be Norway or Nigeria in terms of how they deal with the oil wealth that's coming to them. I mean, I have more confidence in Kurdistan than I do in the rest of Iraq. But it's true that we have never figured out how to square that circle between having our really our only friends in that country are in Kurdistan. And they're also the most reliable, the ones who you could sort of count on. They have a reasonably good militia, the Peshmerga, who unfortunately have been taking a lot of defeats lately at the hands of ISIS. And they have a tolerant society. They respect minority rights. They respect, to some degree, the rights of women. They have a kind of functioning democracy, even though it's very corrupt. And yet, at the same time, we're unwilling to let go of Baghdad as the center. And for a long time, the president and others in the administration were saying, we can't do anything in the north until Baghdad gets its act together. And finally, ISIS just said, well, then we'll have our way in the north. And that pushed the administration's hand. But it seemed as if it took far too long for them to acknowledge things have way outrun those years in which all of our focus had to be on building up a central administration in Baghdad. That is gone. And I think more and more we're going to see the administration letting Kurdistan move away, letting them sell their oil, letting them get on a faster track, which everyone knows is coming, toward independence, and arming the Peshmerga as the de facto army of that coming state, which I learned last week we were actually doing on the down low through the CIA. It hadn't been announced. Now it seems to be coming out through the news. That seems like a practical thing to do. The Peshmerga are the only force in the region able and willing to fight ISIS. So we have to have a strong Peshmerga.
I want to talk about ISIS in a moment, but one more thought about Kurdistan. It seems to me that the leaders in Kurdistan have certainly gotten the endorsement of Chevron and ExxonMobil.
Yeah, and they may well turn out to be more like Nigeria than like Norway. I mean, oil has not been particularly good for governance almost anywhere in the world, certainly not in the Middle East. So there's a lot of dirty dealing in Kurdistan. A lot of Americans have gotten rich and are going to get rich off Kurdistan in a way that they didn't off the rest of Iraq.
How do you characterize ISIS? It seems like they're a cross between the U.S. Army Rangers and the Taliban, in a sense, tactically sophisticated and with an ideological message that's way more terrifying than the Taliban.
I think that's a great description of them. They are superb fighters. They seem fearless. They are heavily armed because the Iraqi army abandoned tens of millions of dollars of American military equipment when they fled the north. And they are truly serious about an ideology of purification, of cleansing. They don't want anything in the Islamic world other than their really extreme, really brutal version of Salafism, extreme Sunni Islam, so that Yazidis have to convert or die. Shiites are infidels and have to be slaughtered. Christians have to be ethnically or religiously cleansed from Mosul because Mosul is a Muslim. I mean, it's amazing how well they've done while every country in the region sees them as an enemy, and yet no country, including us until this week, seems to have realized that it had to take really strong action.
You know, as you describe it, it feels like we're going back in time in the sense that, in sectarian terms, it looks more like 2006. In terms of the U.S. role in this as this air guardian, it looks a lot like the sort of Saddam Hussein years of no-fly zones in the 90s. And in terms of ethnic cleansing, it looks a lot like the Balkans, which we ignored for a long, long time and then confronted Slobodan Milosevic almost when it was too late.
Yeah, when I hear the stories of the Yazidis, this religious minority, a pre-Islamic ancient minority in the Sinjar district of northern Iraq, when I hear the stories of how they were driven from their homes, how the men and women were separated, the men were killed, the women enslaved, I think of Srebrenica. I mean, it's unbelievably similar. And evil is the only word that I can think of to describe the ideas and the behavior of ISIS and their arrogance, their sense of having a right to this place and their confidence. They are so much more confident than anyone else in that area. They're on the offensive. The Kurdish Peshmerga, a vaunted fighting force, are falling back everywhere. And until there were American airstrikes, it looked like Erbil itself, which is their shiny new capital with all these Turkish buildings going up, Erbil was threatened. So it is a little bit of the 90s, a little bit of the 2000s, but it's also, as always, something new. And we're always a couple of steps behind because we don't understand. We don't have the intelligence. We can't grasp it. And at this point, I think there's a reluctance even to want to know, both among the public and in the administration. It's just too much of a nightmare to be dragged back into this country, and yet that's what's happening.
Among his many accolades, winner of the National Book Award, George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
So what could be a unifying force in Iraq right now? The candidates from the Dawa Party, as George Packer described, have so far been the only leaders post-Saddam Hussein. But former Iraqi Minister of Trade, Defense, and Finance and author of Faisal I of Iraq, Ali Alawi, reminds us that before Saddam Hussein, there was a monarchy in that country. Is it time to take a royal route back to unity in divided Iraq? Ali Alawi says the monarchy may be a long shot, but it's hardly a remote idea. The first king of Iraq was a result of the First World War.
When Iraq was first founded in 1921, it followed a monarchical system. And it seemed to provide the right mix of political cover to create an element of stability in a country that has a very varied population. The monarch that we had was not indigenous. He was from the Hejaz in what is now Saudi Arabia. But he came with a long pedigree and was a person who could unite the various disparate groups in a form of determined but moderate patriotism. And the line that he followed, I think, and the fact that he was not really indigenous is, I think, a positive factor. Now, it's very difficult to recreate the conditions of 1921, 100 years later. But I still think we had a very good start as a country. And it was unfortunately dissipated within a very short order. Monarchy didn't last for more than 30 odd years.
And Faisal was one of the Hashemites, right? Of the same family as the Jordanians?
That's right, yes. I mean, that the branch in Iraq was frankly more important because Faisal himself was a much more significant historical figure than any of his brothers. But because the monarchy in Iraq terminated in 1958 in a bloody coup, people associate the Hashemites only with Jordan.
Who would be the link to that royal tradition who's alive today in Iraq?
Well, there are quite a few people who could be considered as legitimate heirs. The most important one, and he in fact went back after 2003, his name is Sharif Ali ibn al-Hussein. His grandfather was King Ali of the Hejaz. So Faisal was his granduncle. But I'm afraid the monarchical system in Iraq didn't get much traction after 2003. For a variety of reasons, it didn't develop into a popular movement.
Is it possible that a constitutional monarchy could span the sectarian problems in Iraq in the sense that you'd have a parliament that would reflect Shia and Sunni and Kurdish constituencies, but that it would be united together by some monarch at the top?
Yes, I think, my opinion, it's in fact one of the few formulas that would work in Iraq. And in particular, the ones that was Faisal I and his descendants, including Sharif Ali and others, they bring to the equation some very, very important advantages. One of them is that they are descendants of the Prophet Muhammad and therefore have great religious legitimacy. Secondly, they have been rulers and custodians over the shrines in the Hejaz of Mecca and Medina for nearly 1,000 years before this was taken over from them by the Saudis. So they are probably the most noble family in the Arab world. Thirdly, they practice a very inclusive and open form of Islam, which makes them acceptable to the very large Shia population in Iraq. At the same time, their form of Arab patriotism is very inclusive, so it includes other nationalities. And that formula could work under certain circumstances in a country such as Iraq, but it obviously needs to be brought to the fore so that people can rally around it.
Are you recommending something of a quota system like you would have in Lebanon, where the king would mediate a parliament that would be drawn on constituencies in some sort of proportional representation scheme?
No, not really. I mean, the king in Iraq is drawn from this kind of background, and he has roots through marriage, perhaps, in the country itself. He can transcend the differences and act as a focal point for groups that would normally not be able to coexist. King Faisal I was able to do that. A lot of it depends on the quality of the individual. So we have the possibilities in Iraq of forming a monarchical system that can act as a kind of magnet for all the various groups, because it transcends and does not really belong to each individual and therefore cannot be seen to be partial.
But the takeaway here would be that you have to find someone who is able, in his personal intelligence and charisma and persuasion, to really appeal to the weariness of Iraqis who are tired of what hasn't been able to be done in Iraq, and that is create a secure, safe environment. Someone who can do that could conceivably unite the people you're talking about, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the ground for such a person has to be prepared. I mean, Faisal came as king as a result of a world war and as a result of the partition of the Middle East in various states, and as a result also, frankly, the primacy of British power in Iraq. If you're going to be able to, as it were, produce a king, there has to be some kind of groundswell of support for such a person, and it has to develop and evolve. It could have happened, and it could still happen, but as things stand right now, it seems to be a long shot. The other issue is that as a result of the coup of 1958, where the royal family in Iraq was killed, they developed a kind of political myth that the revolution was a kind of liberating act. In actual fact, the history of Iraq post-1958 has been extremely bloody and violent. But people's mindsets still think of it as a kind of a step up from monarchical feudalism. It wasn't like that at all. So you have to have an element of re-education to be able to create the foundations for the sort of renaissance of monarchy.
Ali Alawi is the former Minister of Trade, Defense, and Finance in Iraq. He's the author of Faisal I of Iraq. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Some people are ageless, timeless, immortal from the moment they burst into our consciousness. Actress Lauren Bacall was like that.
I tell you, I don't think of what happens after I'm gone. If things last, they last. You never know whether they last or not. And I don't do things for posterity anyway.
Oh, my God. The smoky, sexy voice of Lauren Bacall. She died yesterday after a career in show business that made her the symbol of the tough woman who could do it all with class and brains, irresistible.
You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything, and you don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
She lived to 89. That's Bacall in her 20s, seducing Humphrey Bogart on screen and off. In the movie To Have and To Have Not, and here in the movie The Big Sleep.
Tell me, what do you usually do when you're not working?
Oh, play the horses, fool around.
No women?
Well, I'm generally working on something most of the time.
Could that be stretched to include me?
Well, I like you. I told you that before.
I liked hearing you say it. But you didn't do much about it.
Well, neither did you.
Bacall and Bogart were the glamour power couple. She the bombshell, he the swarthy anti-hero who got the girl. They were the Pitt and Jolie of their day. And just as Jolie was honest with the world about her battles with breast cancer, Bacall and Bogey were also known for their honesty.
In a town that is full of hello, darling, and icing on the cake, you know, saying that everything is wonderful and all the films that are wonderful, it was very difficult to tell the truth. Most people in Hollywood really did not want to hear the truth if it was negative.
Yes.
I mean, only positive. Yes. And Bogey, of course, didn't understand that. He was incapable of telling a lie. He really was.
In this interview with the BBC back in the 1970s, Lauren Bacall is candid about her anxiety as an actress.
Well, it was a result of my nerves, which if you look very closely, you might see again. I used to shake so much that my head used to shake. And, you know, when in a film, when a director says action, there's dead silence on a set. So all eyes are on you and everything depends upon you. And I was such a nervous wreck that I discovered finally that one way to hold my head still was to hold it down. And then the back of my neck got so stiff that nothing would move and look up. And that became the look.
And Lauren Bacall is equally candid in this interview about her regrets over her long career, about not confronting the anti-Semitism of her longtime director, Howard Hawks.
When you start reviewing your life, you have to face your shortcomings. And you can't just shove them under the rug anymore. I don't like moments of envy that I have. I don't like, I don't admire at all in myself the my not having the courage to stand up to Hawks every time he made a crack about the Jews. I don't feel good about that. It took me many years before I could deal with that. And that is what I don't like about myself, the fact that I did not say, now, just a minute, you may as well know it now, and we'll stand. I mean, I wasn't that terrific. I was not that gutsy, and I wasn't that honest about it. I was terrified that maybe I would lose my job, and I didn't have the courage to deal with it.
Lauren Bacall, always the dreamer, that voice, that determination, the whistle, the style, unforgettable.
But I wanted my name in lights. I wanted that dream. I don't know where I got it from, because no one in my family even came close to being in the theater. I don't know. I just had to do it, and I would have done anything, almost anything, and I did almost anything, to be recognized.
And she always will be. Robert Flood wrote on Facebook of Lauren Bacall, she truly put the gold in the golden age of the movies. We are losing so many of our great media treasures and talents. Lauren Bacall always maintained throughout her long career, I am not a has-been. I am a will-be. And so she is.
The He-Men Book Lovers Club, and we take it seriously.
It's time to man up. T.J. Conley is a member of the He-Men Book Club of Minneapolis, taking us to Africa by way of the Twin Cities. They're the latest clubbers in our Takeaway Book Club series. The He-Men are reading All Our Names by novelist Dinah Mengistu. With so much Africa in the news, the He-Men were interested in an adventure story. This one's all about an Ethiopian man displaced by time and place, uneasily at home in America. Here's TJ reading a bit of All Our Names.
On the bus ride to the Capitol, I gave up all the names my parents had given me. I was almost 25, but by any measure, much younger. I shed those names just as our bus crossed the border into Uganda. We were closing in on Lake Victoria. I knew Kampala was close, but even then, I had already committed myself to thinking of it only as the capital. Kampala was too small for what I imagined. That city belonged to Uganda. But the capital, as long as it was nameless, had no such allegiances. Like me, it belonged to no one, and anyone could claim it.
The main character, called Bird because he dreams of flying, is on a journey from war-torn Uganda to Midwestern America. This is a story of identity, love, and the search for home. For 10 years, the He-Men Club has been taking its chances on new authors and challenging books, and Glenn Miller says this book is a winner.
I was riveted. I measure a book's success as to whether I want to return to it at the end of each day, which I certainly did. But then also, does it take me to a place that I've never been before? Or does it put me into a body that I've never been in? Do I understand these characters? Am I empathetic with these characters? And I absolutely was.
That's T.J. Conley, who founded the He-Men Book Club, talking about Dinah Mengistu's All Our Names. He's as Midwestern as they come, and he concurred with Glenn.
I really enjoyed and admire this book. I think it does a terrific job of exploring themes like identity and family history and reinventing ourselves. And I think as a Midwesterner born and bred, you always worry about how Midwesterners are portrayed. And I thought he did a great job. It was a very fair portrayal of kind of life in a small town in Iowa. And I did not feel that it was condescending or anything of that sort.
But Finn Dineski, our third club member, had a few reservations.
I would give a horizontal thumb. I think this book demonstrates that the emotional costs of dislocation and immigration last for generations. And in this book, we find a young man who is blithely unconcerned with politics, tribe, family, and seeks to prove that you don't have to be consumed with your past.
Our He-Men, Glenn Miller, Finn Dineski, and T.J. Connolly were thrilled to take this journey, which taught them a lot about each other, as we learned overhearing their thoughtful discussion. Here's T.J. Connolly.
The narrator, the African narrator, tells us near the beginning of the book that when he was born, he had 13 names, one for each generation of his family from this particular African village. And then, ironically, he ends up with more names during the course of the book than anybody else. He has all sorts of nicknames. And so it really is a story about identity and naming yourself and picking your own name versus being given a name by your family. And in that piece, it's just fascinating.
I'm kind of indifferent to his indifference because I don't understand what makes him tick. His father, when he was a boy, called him Bird because he liked living in the sky, flying above it all. And I think that's his chief characteristic. He doesn't want to be consumed by politics. He wants to float free. And I don't know why he chose to order his life that way. But, you know, he's, of course, free to do that. And some immigrants do that. They come here and want to forget everything. Some don't. Some come here and are very keen on passing their history on to their children. And as an immigration attorney, I've done, in early part of my career, I did a lot of asylum cases. And they're very eager to tell their stories and not forget. Here's a character who's eager to forget. Initially, I was very put off by it, but I think that I am sympathetic to Danao trying to create this character because he himself has made it clear in an interview that I read that he is not interested in being, you know, held down by history, and he floats free himself.
But do you think that getting back to Bird, his name, and this lack of grounding, is that what Mengistu is trying to say that is experienced by some of these immigrants?
Well, in this novel, Bird is the only one who assumes that stance. It's clear at the beginning when he goes to the camp, he says all the other boys have political opinions and they're revolutionaries, socialists, and whatever. So here's a novel in which Bird is the only character portrayed who is seeking to create an identity that is not grounded in Uganda or Ethiopia, where he's from. And I think the author is sort of testing out a way of being, a way of constructing an identity. Can you do this? And yes, I think it's entirely possible.
Wow.
In real life, I've seen people do that. But in this novel, I find that here's a happy young boy with a family that's functional, a caring father, and he just up and decides to leave. That's hard. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
I take a different view of the narrator than Finn does. I find Finn's view of him to be a little harsher. I see him as this ultimate, you know, sort of innocent, naive, sort of passive fellow. I mean, he moves from Ethiopia to Uganda because there had been a writers' conference in Uganda 10 years before that sort of captured his imagination. So he picks up and he leaves this very stable, you know, well-rooted family to go to Uganda. I mean, that's just innocent and naive, you know, and it's almost comical if you think about it. And then I don't think he has any broad or great desires to come to the United States. He sort of falls into it. He fell in with Isaac in the capital and was sort of somewhat politicized by Isaac, although he never takes on Isaac's politics. It's, you know, he drifts. He's a drifter from one situation into another. He's very passive, and he falls into these situations, and then he finds himself in a small town in Iowa and has to recreate himself there once again. So I see him, you know, not as an agent of his own destiny. He's really, you know, he's the reactive type, not the active type.
I would agree with that. I think the strongest action he ever takes in the entire book actually is when he comes to the capital for education. And the rest of the time, it's a pinball is too strong of a word, but he really is kind of following the dictates of those around him. He's very impressionable. But I think we're dancing around a really key theme within this book, and that is around independence. And I think both storylines are looking at that issue in different ways. In the Uganda chapters, they're looking, the author is looking at independence as a nation or as a group of warriors. And in the American chapters, they're looking at individual independence here in America.
All right, He-Man, does the love story work here?
Good question.
And yes. In terms of love stories, John, I would say there are also a couple love story lines going on, certainly between Isaac and Helen. There's the one that and both of whom are seeking an independence of their own.
The other thing that it really informs, and the one issue we haven't talked about, is race relations in this country. And the, you know, that scene in the diner when Helen takes him to lunch at the diner is the most memorable scene in the book to me. It really drives home, you know, here's a guy who basically fled Uganda with a price on his head. I mean, he was in great danger there. He comes to America, you know, the land of milk and honey, and suddenly he's dealing with this whole other issue, this racism issue that he really never had to deal with in Uganda, but which is just as potent and just as troubling. And so it's interesting to watch him get transposed from Africa, where he's dealing with all these bodily threats, to Iowa, where the threats are much more subtle, but just as real. And so I, from my point of view, the sort of the racism piece or the biracial love relationship in the 70s is even more interesting than what was going on in Uganda in the 70s.
I'll jump in. This is Glenn. I didn't actually feel people in the diner, even in the 70s, I didn't feel people in the diner would be reacting quite that way. Now, that may be me living in Minneapolis for much of my life, liberal bastion. I almost wondered if Mengistu was stretching a little bit with some of those scenes. TJ is shaking his head.
I would have to agree with that to some degree. And I think that the small town scenes, maybe that's plausible. I think this is set in, what, 76, 77, 78?
Somewhere in the 70s.
Somewhere in the South, maybe in Missouri. I didn't catch the Iowa thing. I thought it was further south.
I actually thought it was Illinois.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, it's not specific. But there were scenes when I thought, okay, is Bird going to wake up and realize this is a dream? Because for me, Helen struck me as his fantasy woman who takes care of all his needs, his tour guide. They have this sexual relationship that lasts for a year. She doesn't even know his name. And they live in this little bubble, partly because of, in my view, the exaggerated racial reactions of others to them. They stay inside. But they also live in a bubble because of this somewhat flimsy pretext that Henry says, okay, you're going to have to lay low here in the Midwest. And he says, okay, I will live, and I'm quoting now, I will live as if I'm not really here. So he can continue to live in America pretty much as he did in Uganda, as if he's not really there. He's the Birdman, Zen-like detachment. And so I found that the scene with Helen, yeah, there is genuine emotion there. I think they do love each other. But it's a relationship that allows Birdman to exist above it all, separate from engaging really with American society. Just as he, you know, the same way of being that he constructed for himself in Uganda and Ethiopia.
Join the club there. That's Dino Mengistu's book, All Our Names, being discussed by Finn Dineski, TJ Connolly, and Glenn Miller of the He-Man Book Lovers Club in Minnesota. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.